Broadcasting from Manhattan Beach and the World Wide Web, you're listening to CHSR, HealthyLife.net.
As a service to our listeners, this program is for general information and entertainment purposes only. CHSRHealthyLife.net does not recommend, endorse, or object to the views, products, or topics expressed or discussed by show hosts or their guests. We suggest you always consult with your own personal, medical, financial, or legal advisor.
Welcome to Way of the Dreamer. This is Robert Moss. This is where we celebrate and affirm the power of our dreams and of meaningful coincidence and of imagination to renew, refresh our lives, and put us in touch with deeper realities. The doors of the other world open from wherever you are. That's something that we're going to understand very well as we talk to a wonderful guest today. Her name is Perdita Finn. Her new book, which I enjoyed enormously and highly recommend, is called Take Back the Magic, Conversations with the Unseen World, I believe is the subtitle. And Perdita is a lady who lives in the mossy valleys, the dappled light of the Catskill Mountains and the Hudson River Valley, just an hour or so north from where I live in what used to be traditional Iroquois Haudenosaunee country. And we'll talk about how the spirits of the land have been part of her life odyssey and how close she feels to the departed. One of the things we will relearn from Perdita, I found expressed very well by a prophet of the Native American Iroquoian tradition. His name was Hanson Lake. He was a Seneca Indian prophet. And he said this about our relations with the departed. He said, "The distance between the living and the dead is exactly as wide as the edge of a leaf of the maple tree." That's pretty good, isn't it? But of course,
I love it so much.
It's actually even better than that, because as Perdita knows well, it's not necessarily a distance at all. It's a question of variable receptivity, isn't it? So here you are, Perdita, and we have to begin because it came up again just before we came on the air. Tell us about your name. I mean, there's so much of a story in people's names, and often, unfortunately, they don't even pause to ask what the name means. But everybody wants to know the story of Perdita, why you are Perdita, how the name has shaped perhaps your life, shadowed your life, dark or light. So tell us about why you are Perdita and what the name means to you.
Well, this has been a real journey for me. It felt like a real millstone around my neck as a child. You know, everyone was Mary or Anne Marie or Mary Ann growing up, and there I was, you know, everybody stumbling over my strange name, which is from Shakespeare, from one of Shakespeare's difficult plays, The Winter's Tale. And it means lost. And my mother, like one of the good fairies in the fairy tale, kept saying, "Oh, it's about a princess who blesses her parents' old age." And I was the last child of my parents, and so that made a kind of sense. And yet my father, who had bequeathed me the name, used to say, "What else do you call a child born in the 20th century but perdition?" That was a pretty bleak inheritance.
Lost people in the lost century.
Yeah,
but carry on, because you discovered other layers of meaning. And just before you go on, I must add that in A Winter's Tale, the name Perdita is chosen because of a dream. So it is a dream-inspired name in Shakespeare's play, which
I
find
I
very interesting because
that,
you and I are both dreamers.
Oh, well, that adds a whole other layer to it, because and there's a part of me, and my book is about this, Robert, that I think my father did not know consciously why he gave me this name, which would turn out, what had felt like a curse, it turned out to be one of the greatest blessings in my life. Because that play is about, which is such a strange play, and is finally about the healing of a family torn apart by the worst excesses of violence. And it's about the spiritual coming back to life in the lives of the people and the magic returning. And so a name that had seemed to be about a curse was really a story to offer me hidden awarenesses that my father knew he'd made mistakes and prayed that we would heal from them, which we have.
Yes. And as I recall, it is a difficult play and a strange play. And as I recall it probably dimly, at the end of it, Perdita has done well, hasn't she? She's overcome. She survived her father's self-deception and all the terrible things that he wished for without understanding the situation. So she's overcome a father who did not understand. And she's recognized as the rightful princess in the rightful land. And she's got the guy.
Exactly. It's a romance. And it's a romance with a happy ending. But the most beautiful thing about the story at the end is her mother, who everyone had believed the father had killed in a fit of jealous rage, has been preserved in a statue that at the end of the play comes to life. And I am very personally fascinated by divine statues and statues of the divine feminine that come back to life. In fact, I even suspect that Shakespeare, so racked by the religious violence of his day and era, has hid a kind of Easter egg in the play. He would have watched the statues of the Divine Mother destroyed, particularly Our Lady, the Black Madonna of Walsingham. And to bring them back to life has been my work, which has been to bring back that devotion, not just to the mother, but to the what my daughter calls so beautifully the animate everything, where even stones are worthy of divinity.
So. That's very beautiful. In the Iroquoian understanding, Orondath, which is a word for the power that's in everything and beyond everything, is in everything, which is the attitude of you and your highly literate and somewhat animist family. That's your point of view. But they also say that Orondath, that the power that's in everything, clusters in certain places. So a statue, a power object that is made to hold some part of soul or spirit would be a particular concentration point. The Greeks called statues of this kind the breathing images. And it's right there. It's, as you know, if you go back in any cultural tradition, there's this idea that spirit of one kind or another, and spirits of various kinds, can be persuaded to take up residence in objects. I just have to tell you one of my stories, Perdita, before we get on to you and your wonderful book, about how this works in colloquial circumstances today. So some years ago, I was approached by a family who were really going through sort of psychic murk and dysfunction and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, the requested intervention was to support a child, a 9-year-old girl, who was suffering night terrors, which seemed to be connected to all the psychic dysfunction and intrusions and confusion. And to do something quickly, I gave her a toy soldier. It was a Roman soldier. I mean, I'm a boy. I had toy soldiers. I still have toy soldiers. I gave her a plastic one to make it safe, and I said, this is going to be your guardian of the night, if you will it to be so. Just ask him to intervene and defend you if anything goes bump in the night that you don't like. And that just about did the conversation until 3 years later, I met the family at some party, and there's the girl, now 12, and she says, Robert, Lex is great. And I say, who is Lex? And she's, you know, annoyed that I don't know what she's talking about. Oh, he's the Roman soldier you gave me. Oh, yes, what's happened? Well, he's 10 feet tall, and he's on the case. If anything's going wrong in the night, Lex is on it, and he defends me. So I thought this is an example of what the ancients understood. You can provide a place where power will gather and concentrate itself, and it will work, and you attract and draw into the right object. Of course, it might be made with great skill and great love and great craftsmanship, but you know, an old plastic soldier from my toy box did the trick that time.
Oh, Robert, I love that story. One, because there is a children's book I loved called Knight's Castle by Edward Eger as a child about the toy soldiers that come awake at night to play with the children.
Tell me the title again. I have to get this.
It's just marvelous. It's called Knight's Castle by Edward Eger. And it's very funny, but very alive about how these figures come to life to protect the children in the story.
Thank you. This conversation is already beyond my wildest dreams, Perdita. We're now going to toy soldiers. And the boy in me is clapping his hands and jumping up and down. My favorite story from childhood was called The Steadfast Tin Soldier. I don't know whether that ever made it.
Well, this is about
being
sold.
I love that so much. And we were doing a training recently where we were invited by one of my teachers of active dreaming as an exercise to go back to a story from childhood and let it come alive and let one of the characters speak. And that's what came to me. All right, we must talk about your wonderful book, Taking Back the Magic.
Well, I will use the toy soldier as a breakup and just to say that, you know, one of the things I try to help people do is to make space for the dead, for them to gather in objects.
Yes.
And in our culture, that's photographs most often, you know. But long before people had photographs, they would create dolls and stones and objects that the dead could occupy with their energy, just as you've described in your wonderful story. And that those, you know, they become bequeathed objects, you know, in families for many generations, and they accumulate the power of devotion and prayer and become really quite magical. So I always invite people to make space for the dead in their homes. That's part of my big work with objects.
Very, very interesting indeed. And I'd love you, if you would like to do so, to give us some more examples of how people could approach this as simple everyday rituals and ways of holding the space and maintaining communication. Let's talk about some of your main themes here. One of your main themes in my mind is the nearness of the dead, that our dead are with us or around us, and this might be for mutual benefit and healing and forgiveness and communication. And your own story of relations with some people on the other side tends to confirm that. So talk to us on that theme, and let me just hand you the mic, so to speak, for a while to develop that theme as you choose.
Well, let me explain what I mean by the dead and why I say the dead and not just ancestors. Because when
right.
I speak about ancestors, we tend to think of our grandparents or our great-great-grandparents. And I'm thinking about every soul on the other side, not just every human soul, but every soul. You know, we know that the law of conservation of energy and matter is that nothing goes anywhere. It's all right here. And we've all always been here. And we'll always be here. And the dead are quite literally beneath our feet. If we, wherever you are listening to this, go outside and scrape up a little bit of dirt in your fingers. And that's the bodies of the dead. The bodies of dead insects and dead stones. Those stones are the bodies of dead oceans, dead volcanoes and dead stars. Dirt is nothing but the bodies of the dead, dead forests, dead birds, dead animals. And it's that dirt out of which everything grows. All of our lives are born from the dirt of the dead. And our very bodies have been born in the bodies that have come before us. And so all of those souls on the other side love us and are available to us and want to collaborate with us in the business of growing and blooming and ripening. And we can work with them to do that. This was a sort of slow discovery for me, Robert, very much from the inside out. I found myself just talking to the dead, all the dead. Certainly my grandparents and my aunts and uncles and friends who had died in the AIDS epidemic and pets. But then also, you know, the chipmunk who was dead beside the road and the gravestone that I passed every day and the name I couldn't stop thinking about. We are woven not from, we are not the product of a lineage. A lineage is sort of a very narrow idea of understanding our ancestral experience. We're the product of root systems, entangled, complicated, knotted, mostly mysterious and underground root systems. And just like those root systems will occasionally pop up a mushroom, here we are having popped up papawi in the middle of the night. And beneath us are vast, complex networks of intimacy that we can not necessarily ever understand, but that we can begin to pull on and feel that whole fabric of existence kind of shimmering around us. So that's sort of in a nutshell what I think.
Well, you put it in such a magical way. You have the gift of goodly speech, as the Celts call it, both, you know, on the page and in the spoken oral narrative, which is a great and wonderful thing because we know so many writers who cannot speak and so many narrators who cannot write. You can do both. So people, as they listen to you, can savor already the quality, the exquisite quality of your writing. It's there on the page. When you talked about the gravestone, I just have to tell you another of my little stories, of the story from the road. So in the days before the pandemic, when I was flying all the time, I actually, approaching an airport, said out loud, I don't need a new story today because often the best stories are mediated by screw-ups, misconnections, etc., as you know. If nothing goes wrong, it's not such a good story. So I want a smooth flight home. But here I'm waiting for my plane, and I go to the bar. I'm in Australia, and I'm going to have a beer. And a ruddy, cheerful fellow at the bar says, oh, you look like a guy who'd like to hear a good story. And I say, well, that's correct. You have great intuition. He introduces himself. He's a retired detective from the East Bay area. He's moved to what he calls a gentleman farm in Oregon. And he says, I need to tell you this. Go ahead. I'm walking in a cemetery I've never been to before, yes. And I'm thinking about a girl I loved and could never have 30 years ago. Oh, okay. And I look down, and there on the headstone is a three-part name, Italian name, and the death date is last summer, and I think this cannot be. And I'm listening. And he says, I should better make some calls. It's her. It's her. It's her name on the headstone. I never knew she was in Oregon. I'd never been to the cemetery. What do you think? Well, I just said I think it's a very good story. But, you know, listening to you and the webs of connection, et cetera, one cannot but feel that there was a magnetism there, that he was drawn in a way which defies ordinary reason and yet might answer to a deeper reason, you know, logic that reason does not know. So we're all connected. We both love stories. Tell me, if you will, some stories about your own connections and those that you have mediated or observed between people living now and people living on the other side of death and what they've led to, how they might have helped, how guidance might have been exchanged. Because I'm very interested in this. And it's one of the things that I think you do the same, but it's one of the things I've long tried to help people understand that healing and forgiveness are always available, even across the apparent barrier of death, and we can do mutual good, mutual benefit for each other. So tell us some stories about this.
Well, I'll tell you one that I love that happened to me and really surprised me. And so my daughter has a genetic illness that necessitates a lot of doctor's visits. And if anyone's ever spent time in the medical system, they know how frustrating and how terrifying and unhelpful it can be.
Yes.
And during COVID, she had to go see a new doctor in New York City. And I unfortunately would not be able to go into the examining room with her because of COVID restrictions. And so on the way down to the city, Robert, I was feeling anxious about this doctor's visit. Like so often they can be, my daughter says they, not only do the doctors not know how to use placebos anymore, they mostly offer nocebos. They make you feel worse and sicker after you go to see them. So I was assembling a medical team on the other side for my doctor. My father was a doctor. So I was calling in all of his buddies and a lot of the nurses I knew, as well as the secretaries and those people who made the whole experience better. And all of a sudden, as we're driving down to New York City, I remember for no apparent reason a man in my small town growing up. And his name was Viggo Peterson. He was a Swedish, son of Swedish immigrants. And he ran the local ice cream parlor.
Ah.
And Robert, this is a tiny town, and the ice cream was delicious, just the best ice cream you've ever eaten in your life. And then every morning, Viggo would post what flavors he'd made the night before, and word would spread around town, you know, oh, he's made ginger tonight, or oh, he's made strawberry ice, and everybody would run down to get it. But Viggo himself was sort of a monster, and he had a whole slew of young women who worked for him that he just tortured. He made them wear hair knots and gloves, and he yelled at them all day long. And when they were serving the ice cream, he was often reducing them into tears. And it turned out my father got to know Viggo because his parlor was so clean. And my father joked him one day. He said, I should have you come in and prepare the operating room for me. You're so clean here. And Viggo said, I wanted to be a doctor. And his father hadn't let him. He'd had to take over the ice cream business.
Mm.
So my father started letting him come to watch him do surgeries from time to time. And I realized, why not put Vigo on the medical team for my daughter? Let him bring some sweetness to the table. Let him bring some unexpected sweetness to this doctor's visit.
Yes.
That's my thought. We go into the city. My daughter goes into her appointment. 2 hours later, she comes out. And this is a bona fide miracle in my book. She says, Mom, that doctor was wonderful. She says I'm doing so well. She says I do everything right. She says that together we can really get me better. I think, wow, that doesn't happen very often.
Yes.
So I come home. The story's not over yet. And I'm teaching a class because I teach people how to collaborate with those on the other side. And I'm sharing this story about, you know, you may want to put somebody unexpected in one of your projects you're working on, and you're not clear. Wasn't really clear why Vigo popped into my head. But here he was, and he seems to have done the trick. And a woman in my class from Canada says, not Vigo Peterson from Marion, Massachusetts. And I say, yes. And she said, my sister worked for him in the late 1960s. And she says, it was the worst summer of her life. It was horrible. It was a terrible summer. He totally tortured her. She was in tears. You know, she thought she was going to have some magical summer in a seaside town serving ice cream. And instead, you know, he made her life a living hell. And she said, do you mind if I share this story with her? She's on a bit of a medical journey right now with cancer, and it's not going very well. I said, of course. So she shared this story with her sister, and her sister said, if Vigo can get me better, I'll put a picture of him up in my home.
Oh.
And all will be forgiven between us.
Mm.
And she went into full remission, Robert.
What a delicious, marvelous story, healing with the ice cream doctor. And we're talking with Perdita Finn. Her wonderful new book is Take Back the Magic. We'll be back to hear more after the break. We've already entered one of the fields that I really want to explore, Perdita, which is the play of synchronicity. You're listening to The Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. Back after the break.
Robert Moss has a collection of books, audio, video, and DVD products that will help you bring the creative and healing gift of dreams into your everyday life. Revitalize your work and relationships and journey to the furthest reaches of your imagination. These books are tools that everyone can use to begin or enhance active dreaming in their lives. Visit mossdreams.com. That's mossdreams.com. MOSSDREAMS.com.
Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com. Get your personal dream symbols and discover the ones you dream about in Linda McKenzie's Symbols of You, a new book available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Target, and more.
You're listening to HealthyLife.net, the radio network that brings positive talk with positive change to make your world a little better.
Welcome back. You're listening to Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. Our extraordinary guest today is Perdita Finn, who just told us a lovely tale of really recruiting a committee of helpers on the other side, including an ice cream man who could offer medical support and so on to someone in need and could extend that to others. And we saw the play of synchronicity. Perdita, you and I both live by synchronicity. I made up a word for that practice, which is chiromancy, K A-I-R-O-mancy, chiromancy, which incorporates the name of the Greek god Kairos, who is the god of special moments, opportunity moments, jump times. In your book, which is partly a delicious memoir, Take Back the Magic, you talk about the role of synchronicity in your life. And I must say that it even comes into play with your name, because when I think about Perdita, meaning lost, I also think that one of the rules of navigating by synchronicity in life might be stated like this. In order to find ourselves, we might first have to get lost. You know, right. Need to be lost in order to get found. That's the story of serendipity. Sinbad the sailor can't find the magical kingdom of Serendip. So he gets lost, loses his ship, loses his maps, loses his shipmates, and washes up on what seems an alien shore and discovers he found the magic kingdom that everybody's been looking for but could not find until he got hopelessly lost. So, you know, I've noticed that in my own life. Sometimes you really have to recognize you do not know where you are in order to find a new way of going to a place you did not previously know. So talk to me about, you know, how you find signs and symbols and everyday magic and how the world speaks to you and how you listen.
Well, that's everything, I suppose. And I love the word chiromancy, which I'm going to take really to heart right now, because synchronicity feels like, you know, coincidence, like it's just like happenstance. And what I love about chiromancy is it's the deep old magic from the bottom of time. You know what I mean? That's what we feel like we're beginning to tap into.
Well, the word chiromancy shifted to the practice, not just the phenomenon, but the magic bit. It's about doing magic.
And that one can feel, you know, how do we know we're on the right path when we're in the dark? Like, we can only step into the magic, in the darkness, you know, and that we're not going to necessarily know where we are or where we're headed, but this is the only way we're going to see the shooting stars, is if we're out at night in the darkness. And we begin to find our way because so many things start to fall together and so many pieces fall together, right? And you know, I'm tempted to tell a tale. It's not the tale I normally tell, but, you know, much of my book ends by talking about a woman who began to appear to my husband in the middle of the night. And who she was, you know, who was she? She began offering things to say, and I didn't see her, but he did. I thought she was somebody dead, perhaps, but he insisted she was the most alive person he'd ever met. And I had been, we were up on Cape Cod about 3 months after this whole strangeness began, which I detail in my book. And the lady invited him to pray the rosary. Him to be Catholic. He wasn't. He was an ex-Buddhist. And I wasn't Catholic either, nor was I even Christian, but I also prayed the rosary for reasons I couldn't explain to anyone at all. I found it very consoling, very soothing. And so this lady ultimately, you know, invited him to pray the rosary, and we both sort of looked at each other and said, oh, you know, are we going to have to become Catholic? How awful, you know. And we were on vacation up on Cape Cod, and we walked into a used bookstore that morning right after we had our coffee. And there on a table amid all the romance novels and the mystery novels that you would find in a beach town on vacation was a single blue paperback book called, you know, Messages from Our Lady of Medjugorje. Very unlikely book. And my husband picked it up and opened it up, and at the top it said, does the lady invite everyone to pray the rosary whether or not they are Catholic? And it said, yes, anyone can pray the rosary. They don't have to be Catholic. And it was, we both looked at each other and said, oh, you know, synchronicity, you know, this book, this moment, this bookstore, and we're trying to take it in. And our teenage daughter is insisting that she wants to leave the bookstore and go clothes shopping. And we're trying to resist her. And she's insisting, pulling us out, demanding we leave the bookstore. We can't think of any more excuses. So we follow her to some incredibly high-priced tourist town clothing shop where we're going to have to then resist buying her some high-priced piece of clothing. And we walk in, and it's filled with rosaries. And my husband says, why? And of course, also some very high priced clothing. And then my husband says to the owner of this tiny little store, why are there so many rosaries here? And the woman says, well, she says, I'm not Catholic, she said, but I'm a devotee of the Black Madonna. Mm. And suddenly our guide appeared to help us navigate this very complicated moment. And I mean, there were more synchronicities beyond that. But I think what happens, my experience has been that the way I know I'm on the right path and the path of my heart, I know you've just finished the book on the heart's desire, which I think about all the time as kind of, how do I know when I'm on the path of the heart? It's when these chiromancy moments blossom all around me, when I am supported by the cosmos, when I am reassured and guided by the cosmos where I need to go. So that's the short story of what I've experienced.
Well, that's a wonderfully illuminating, rose-centered exposition. I mean, it helps us to understand the phenomenon. Yes, synchronicity does cluster around us according to the thoughts and emotions we carry. And the stronger our thoughts and emotions, of course, the stronger the effects on the world around us. I mean, I think for good or bad, our attitude always goes ahead of us in life, shaping the events and encounters that lie around the next corner. And as you say beautifully, it is great confirmation of a project, of a cause, whether it's the way of the rose or something else, when the universe starts giving us one thing after another. Sometimes when I'm going through a rush of synchronicity, one thing after another, I feel I can hear voices behind the curtains of our everyday perceptions whispering and sometimes chuckling and saying things like, shall we give him another? Is that enough? Or shall we just do one more? Let's just throw one more in to make sure he doesn't miss it. So there'll be the multiplication, which is, of course, why the word synchronicity is so inadequate, as Wolfgang Pauli, who worked with Jung on the whole theory, kept pointing out, because synchronicity just means things happening at the same time. Yes, and we notice that. We feel something. The world gives us something that resembles what we're feeling in the external reality. But synchronicity runs in rifts, doesn't it? It runs, we can notice rhyming symbols that go on for days, weeks, or even the whole lifetime. Things come up again and again. So it's the connection by meaning rather than the connection in the same, say, in the same moment of synchronous time that really counts, which is why Pauli wanted to call it isomorphy, which means identity or near identity of form. So your stories are full of these wonderful examples of letting the world speak to you and being ready to listen and being ready to act on the messages that are being received. And with your poet's soul, of course, you recognize that it's about more than getting a left, right, yes, no kind of answer.
Right.
It's about attending to the weave of it all. You talked earlier in a lovely way about pulling on the threads of the web, and you sounded as you did that like one of those weird sisters in the benign sense, pulling on the threads of weird, W-Y-R-D, the threads of weird. That bind reality. So this is what it's about. This is magic that we can live and magic that connects us to the animate universe. There's one, I have so many themes I want to hear you talk about some more. I think I'll save the question that I want to ask until after the break. Let's just tell people again why they need to find you and your book. The book is Take Back the Magic, Conversations with the Unseen World. It's out now. It's being embraced by many people whose opinions I value, and I think that you value too. And the lovely author is Perdita Finn. Perdita, if people want to find you online, where do they go?
TakeBackTheMagic.com. That's where you can...
TakeBackTheMagic.com. See, your fingers will tingle as you tap that out. TakeBackTheMagic.com. You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. Go over to my website, too, please, mossdreams.com. You'll see I'm about to offer a whole slew of new trainings and programs, some in person, mostly online, and that's working very well. We'll be back after the break.
Thank you. Since ancient times, indigenous people from every culture have used their dreams to help interpret their lives, the world around them, and the future. Now you can tap into this indigenous wisdom with Robert Moss's workshops and classes, all designed to help you learn more about you and your connection to the dream world. If you're interested in finding out about how to host a class or workshop in your area, email Robert at robert@mossdreams.com. Or to find out about Robert's ongoing schedule of classes and workshops offered worldwide, visit his website, mossdreams.com.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
You're listening to Way of the Dream with Robert Moss. Our lovely guest is Perdita Finn. Her excellent new book is Take Back the Magic. Perdita, reading you, I've forgotten the exact details, but there's a moment, I think, when you're talking about how an animal, a beloved animal, maybe a pet, might take on symptoms for the owner, the one that feeds it and loves it. And as I was reading this, I was thinking how true this has been in my observation and how it also has analogues in the experience of ancient and indigenous cultures. In fact, you sent me back to a passage I read in Piers Vitebsky's extraordinary book, The Reindeer People, based on the time that he spent living with the Evenk, shamanic people of Central Asia. And amongst this reindeer herding people, he said, a certain animal is recognized. It's called the Kujai, K-U-J-J-A-I, as I recall, sometimes called the reindeer with shaman eyes. And this is the animal that, in return for being looked after, loved, fed, tended by its master or its mistress, its owner, will take on symptoms and even death from the physical human. And that's part of the deal. And when that happens, perhaps the human will be fortunate enough to win another such ally. Does this speak to you in terms of your observation and experience of our relations with the animal world?
Absolutely. And you know, I had a lot of experiences. I grew up in a house filled with animals. My mother adored animals and never said no to an animal. So that I grew up in a house with, I think, at least 12 cats, you know, and three dogs and a boa constrictor and an iguana. And, you know, there is bunnies and gerbils. I mean, it was really a fecund and lively place. And my mother was quite devoted to animals. One of her great delights was we had a cat door, and one night she woke up, and the cat had hopped up in the bed, and she brought it close to her to stick it under the covers beside her. And she looked down, and it was a very startled raccoon. And she was just thrilled by that. she dreamt of getting to cuddle with lions. It was her great dream. But, so she was quite devoted to these animals, and my mother got cancer when she was 70, and she was told that she would only at most have 3 months to live. And she was a very fierce person, and she said to the doctor, you know, I haven't met my grandchildren yet. You know, can you treat me? And he said, well, I can, Pat, but it's not going to do anything. And she said, you know, might it? And he said, well, you know, it's a 1% chance. And she said, okay, so that's what we're doing. And so she began a really brutal chemotherapy. You know, the old days of chemo were particularly terrible, and radiation up and down her back to treat this non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and, you know, chemo that would leave her vomiting all night long. But the thing that most upset my very vain mother is the fact that she lost all her hair.
Mm.
And in the midst of all this, one of the cats, the most indolent and useless of all these many cats, was this white Persian that she had named Baudelaire because he was so deaf.
Baudelaire. Perfect.
And Baudelaire was just a kind of, couldn't even be bothered to clean himself kind of cat. And we used to call him Bodhi for short. Bodhi became devoted to my mother during her illness, and he would drape himself over her head and become her hair during the day, which pleased my mother to no end. And he wouldn't leave her side. We had to feed him beside her and put his kitty litter in her bedroom. And my mother, who couldn't stand the smell of anything at that point, didn't seem to mind because she just loved having this cat close to her. And she went back to the doctor after 3 months. She was still alive, but he told her that the chemo wasn't working. And he thought that they should stop, and that it was really, there wasn't any more hope. And we came home that night, and we were sitting on her bed in the dark, and I was petting the cat, and I realized that there were lumps all the way down her spine. And the next morning, I brought him to the vet, who our family knew well, and he said, look, he's riddled with cancer. He's going to be dead in 24 hours, which he was. And I know you can say, you know, he had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma from the same glyphosate my mother was using in her garden. But my mother got better.
Yes.
And the tumors disappeared, and she, you know, she lived for another 12 years.
Yes.
And what I remember, I told this story to my husband when I first met him, the ex-Buddhist monk, and he said, Bodhi? I said, yeah, short for Baudelaire. And he said, oh, no, Bodhi, short for Bodhisattva. And a Bodhisattva, as you know, Robert, is a being who pledges to be reborn for eternity for the salvation of all beings.
Yes.
And in Buddhism, you know, I got fascinated by the Jataka tales, which are the stories of the Buddha sacrificing himself as an animal to feed hungry travelers or to help people in need. But I think all animals are Bodhisattvas.
Yes.
And plants and trees. I think we're the species that's forgotten how to do this effortlessly.
Yes. Extraordinary name magic, isn't it, too? From Baudelaire to Bodhi to Bodhisattva and Bodhi tree,
right.
Perhaps. So interesting. And it seems like a very fair and spiritual and, you know, necessary exchange. Thank you for telling that. That story is in your book, and that's what I was fishing for, in the waters of my memory, and so readers can find it in your extraordinary book, Take Back the Magic. I must say, I find that many people today are sometimes more comfortable with meeting deceased animals that they have loved than their deceased humans. Sometimes there's a little certain amount of family drama to be overcome before they're ready to deal with the humans, but they're often cheered and awakened by contact, especially in dreams, but also sometimes by a sense of presence with departed animals. Dogs and cats that have shared my life have been very, very important part of my own guidance system. I had a black dog that I loved enormously. He was killed on the road the night before Halloween many, many years ago, and I buried him with my hands on the edge of the human graveyard on the hill beside the farmhouse that I bought because of a red-tailed hawk and a white oak. And Kipling was around for the year after his death, almost physically, driving in the Jeep where he loved to drive. We'd have to say, lie down, Kipling, we can't see through the rear vision mirror. He was around to that extent until I did a ceremony and burned some meat for him, and the smoke turned and went to his gravesite and released him on that level. And then he returned in my dreams as a kind of, you know, backyard Anubis, all every day, every night life, and then other dogs and cats appeared to me. Recently, the Calico, the rescue cat, beautiful rescue cat we adopted when she was 9 years old, came to me and said, I want to show you Cat City now. We had a tour. We had a tour of Cat City, and she wanted me to know that there are bad kitties as well as good ones, bad neighborhoods as well as good neighborhoods, and be discerning as you travel the roads and alleys of Cat City. So, you know, I mean, many of us love animals. We've never had 12 cats, but we got up to 4 in the house and 6 we were feeding when we were living on the farm. All very good stuff. And I think we're going to have some more very good stories to share in our last 8-minute segment. So let's think about what you would most like to bring us. I thank you again for your wonderful gift of stories, because I think we agree that stories are the shortest route between most humans and the truth. Carry knowledge, you know, unsullied and strong and energizing. And I think we also both know that the act of telling the right story to another person can be a way of conferring power. It can be a way of word doctoring. We can even invite them inside the right story, as if bringing them inside a home with a hearth and a fire that can renew them and give them light on their darkest days. So you help, through the beauty of your telling, you help us to understand the importance of reviving the almost lost art of telling and making stories. We need this in our times. We need it now. So we're talking to Perdita Finn, Lost and Found, and we're talking about her wonderful book, Take Back the Magic. We'll be back for more of this, What a Treat, after the break.
Where can you find out about dreams and the dream world? MossDreams.com. At MossDreams.com, you can find out about Robert Moss, his work, and discover the way of the dreamer. Read numerous articles and essays on almost every facet of dreams. Find out Robert's class and workshop schedule. Read reviews and so much more. Visit MossDreams.com to find your way of the dreamer. That's MossDreams.com.
Robert Moss has a deep engagement with the dream world, and now you can take a crash course from this master of active dreaming at your own pace. That's right. You can get Robert's 8 exciting half-hour programs on a new DVD set called Way of the Dreamer. Share Robert's story as a dreamer and dream healer. This dynamic 3-DVD set can help teach you how to find your way through your dreams to realize your full potential. Don't wait to learn the practical dreamwork techniques that can help you understand how to attain better health, emotional stability, spiritual awareness, and more. Order Way of the Dreamer DVDs today from Amazon.com or MossDreams.com. That's MossDreams.com.
We're HealthyLife.net, reaching and helping a worldwide audience without hype, without shock, and without shenanigans.
Welcome back. This is Way of the Dreamer with Robert Moss. Do you like good stories? Do you find your own? The ones do you go back to in your memory, maybe from childhood? Are the ones that you have told your children or ones that you tell someone you love by the fire or anyway in the cool of the evening? But Edith Stin is a great storyteller, and like me, she loves the power of story. So, Benita, let's talk a little bit about story making and the stories that we go back to and the stories that bring us up and bring us forward in life.
Well, I am a storyteller, and I am married to a storyteller, a Southern storyteller, who I say in his family, storytelling is like jazz, you know. One person tells one story, and then someone else rips off and tells another. But one of the things I've become fascinated by is the stories we tell about those who are left behind, who have passed on. And what is the story that we ourselves will leave behind? What if there was only one story that would be told about us after we died? What would it be? And what story will last? I think I'll give you an example. My mother had a great uncle, and the story that was told about this great uncle was that he was a guardian angel to the family, that his brother had died too young and left behind a family and children, and there were no resources, and the two brothers were going to flip a coin to see who would go to work and which one would go to college, you know. And suddenly the guardian uncle swooped in and said, everyone's going to college, even the daughter, and took care of the family. And this good uncle, Uncle Bert was his name, that's the only story I knew about him. And it was told so often in the family that the idea of the good uncle became a kind of powerful myth in the family, so much so that my own husband, 3 generations later, is said, I need to be the good uncle. I want to be a good uncle, not just a good father, but a good uncle, you know, worthy of Uncle Bert. What does it mean to be a good uncle? And, you know, and the men in the family had really wanted to be good uncles. And I got curious one day about Bert about 10 years ago. Who was he? You know, who was the good uncle? Could I find his gravesite? Well, I started to research him, Robert, and I found out he had been the president of the Bank of America.
Wow.
And nobody had thought to share that detail about his life. None of the details of his life had been passed down. None of his resume, none of his professional achievements, not his portfolio. But then I found a newspaper article about him as a young man in Brooklyn, and that he had a lumber company, and he'd been swindled by his uncle, who had taken all his money. And I realized that swindled by the bad uncle, he had become the good uncle. And the only thing that had remained about him in family storytelling was that he had done a good deed, and that good deed had a power so powerful that generations, 100 years later, it was still affecting people's behavior who had never met him. And so one of the things I like to think about is, I sometimes think about a question for myself is, what story do I want to tell about my own ancestors? If I could tell one story about each of those I love on the other side, what would it be?
Yeah.
One story about my mother, one story about my father. And then I also sometimes have to ask myself, and what is the one story that will be told about me 7 generations from now?
Yes. Well, the 7-generation thing, as you probably know, comes from the Iroquois, the people whose traditions I had to learn because I started dreaming in an ancient form of the Mohawk language, and I had to study it. That's where it comes from. It's a very good idea, I find, to try to think and imagine 7 generations beyond ourselves, and also to go back 7 generations before ourselves. And when I do that personally, I don't confine myself to genealogy. I don't confine myself to the biological family. I think we're in agreement on this. Our lives turn on other lives from other lineages, which are connected to us in one way or another. It might be reincarnation. It might be that we're members of a multidimensional soul family whose lives are, from a certain point of view, going on right now. I go back 7 generations to the mother of the wolf clan of the Kanyenka Haka, the Mohawk people, and the Irishman she tried to influence, who was a very close connection of mine, in order to try to understand something of the larger story. You were quite firm in your book in saying we probably won't understand our own lives and our own dramas without grasping how they turn upon things that have happened or are still happening or will happen in other times and places. And I'm with you on that. I think that, you know, one life story is connected to others, and you write about that in ways that are very provocative also. I like when you talk about the good uncle, the fact that what is remembered is the heart story, the story with all the heart and not the resume story. And that may, I couldn't initially understand why people wouldn't recollect the fact that he'd had this big banking job. Well, the thing is that they're remembering the thing that he did that showed such depth of heart, not the stuff that shows up nicely on a resume.
And I think that also the stories we tell, we can learn from the lives of the saints, too. Sometimes people don't do very well in life, you know. A lot of lives, like they always say, it's hard to understand a soul just from the short story of a single life. But some lives look like just sort of mediocre failures, right? Abjection, suffering, not much happening. And yet all of that failure, all of those disappointments can become compost for the soul. And out of that can become really mighty acts that people can be remembered for. You know, St. Anthony is one of people's favorite saints. You know, he's so adept at finding things, right? People always are calling on St. Anthony to help them find things. And St. Anthony is like the Uncle Bert of the saint world because nobody remembers his brilliant sermons, you know, and so impressed everyone of the day, or his theological understanding, or his sophisticated doctrine. They just ask for his help in finding stuff, and 1,000 years later, people are still asking him to find things for them, and he's still showing up and helping out and getting the job done. And
I'm chuckling over you mentioning St. Anthony of Padua. That's the Anthony you're referring to, right? Because you probably know, Anthony of Padua is regarded in Santeria, you know, the New World version of the old Yoruba thing, as the equivalent of Ishu Alegua, who is the gatekeeper. When you make an offering undercover, which is less necessary than it used to be in colonial times, when you want to make an offering to the great gatekeeper and trickster of West Africa, you go to St. Anthony of Padua, and that's where you make your offering, because you understand that under the mantle of the Catholic saint is the black and red luster of the Orisha, of the river. I've seen Anthony of Padua invoked in one sense or the other work wonders, so I'm not opposed to the idea that miracles happen and that devotion might have its consequences. What an extraordinarily interesting conversation. Another hour, but we don't. Do you have any last thought very briefly for us before we just go away and then come back and say thank you.
Well, I would like to just say that how grateful I am for your work, Robert. That, you know, when you're having all of these coincidences, synchronicities, deja vus, visitations in our dreams, I was quite overwhelmed by it as a young woman. And I was having a lot of precognitive dreams and visitations and travelings, and I didn't know how to make sense of any of it. And I encountered your work, and I felt this exhale of, oh, there are people thinking about this. This is what's happening. This is not the dissolution of who I am. This is who I am. And so I guess the last thing I want to say is that your work has been just a profound gift to me personally, and it's been such an honor and pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, you have such a generous and deep heart, Perdita. Thank you very much. We've been talking to Perdita Sen. We'll be back to say thank you and dream on after the break.
HealthyLife.net, where positive overcomes negative.
You've been listening to Way of the Dreamer. Our extraordinary guest today is Perdita Sen. Her book, which I strongly recommend, is Take Back the Magic. And Perdita, you help us to do that. You help us to bring back the magic of connection with the natural world, connection with the ancestors and our departed loved ones. You help us to revive the gift of story. Thank you for all that you are and all that you do.
Thank you so much, Robert, for having me on. It has been a pleasure beyond measure. Thank you.
All right. Until next time, and as we all go forward on the roads of life and the roads of soul, may our doors and gates and paths be open, and may the doors and gates and paths of any who wish to do us or those we love any harm be closed. May it be so.